Okay, so this is the concluding roundtable, which is going to be moderated by Thierry Gervais, and which I want to be known. Yes, I have all the names here. So, which is composed of Susan Carrotton, Louis Palou, and also Vincent Lavoie and Thierry Gervais. So I'll just be introducing Thierry Gervais. And then Thierry will pick this up, and he'll introduce everyone, and each member of the panel will be talking about 10 to 15 minutes. So Thierry Gervais is assistant professor at Ryerson University Toronto and head of research at the Ryerson Image Center. He received his PhD from the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales in Paris in 2007. He teaches history of photography and is pursuing research about the use of photography in magazines and the first photo reporters. He is the editor-in-chief of Études photographiques and the author of La photographie, ou La photographie, histoire, technique, presse, art. With Gaël Morel-Larousse, 2008. He is also currently working on a book about photographic illustration and the birth of spectacular information. Alors, so Thierry, c'est à vous. Where are you, Thierry? Okay.
Thank you very much, Christine. Well, so we have three presenters today. Who will give us a presentation about 15 minutes, and then we should have time for a Q&A session, I would say about half an hour, maybe 45 minutes. The first of our presenters is Suzanne Carrotton, who is a professor in history at Rutgers University, Newark, New Jersey. Suzanne has written widely on various aspects of war, communication, and representation. In addition to numerous essays and reviews, Suzanne is the author of several books, including War and the Media, published by Palgrave in 2000 and republished in 2010, and Cold War Captives at the University of California Press in 2009. She is also a contributing writer for Cineast, and has published several essays for that magazine on film and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Suzanne is currently working on an history of the United States as an occupying power. And Suzanne will give a talk titled Why Can't We See Insurgent? The second presenter is Vincent Lavoie, who has been a professor in the Department of Art History at UCAM since 2005. He began teaching the history of photography at the University of Ottawa before continuing to do so at the University of Paris 8 and then at Paris 1, while working in parallel as a critic and editor for contemporary art magazines. Having worked as an assistant curator of photography at the National Gallery of Canada, as a research curator at the McCord Museum, and as a guest curator for Le Mois de la Photo à Montréal in 2003, Vincent has produced exhibitions on contemporary photography as much as on amateur and vernacular practices. Vincent is a member of Figura, a research center on text and imagination, and a member of the editorial board of Études Photographiques. His last book, entitled Photojournalism, Revoir les canons des images de presse, was published in 2010 by Edition Hazan in Paris. And last but not least, the third presenter, Louis Palou, who is an award-winning Canadian photojournalist. I forgot to say that Vincent will talk about the use of the iPhone in the war context. Louis's work has appeared in numerous books, catalogs, festivals, and exhibitions internationally. In 2010, he was awarded an Alexia Foundation grant for a five-year project on Kandahar, Afghanistan, the Hearst Photography Biennial Award, and Canadian Photojournalist of the Year. His work has been published in numerous publications worldwide, including The New Yorker, The New York Times, Paris Match, Time, Newsweek, and The Atlantic. He is currently a Bernard L. Schwartz Fellow with the New America Foundation for Study on the Violence in Mexico. And we will talk about his experience as photographer, photojournalist, and maybe artist. But first, Suzanne.
I'd like to begin by thanking Media at McGill very much for the invitation to be here. Thank you all for coming, and it's perhaps an even greater pleasure than I'd expected, having left storm-struck Newark, where we were without electricity and the internet and modern conveniences for the last several days, to be in a place where everything works. So thank you all. So I've posed my title as something of a provocation, and I have a number of purposes in mind. The sort of overwhelming observation which animates my comments is the striking visual asymmetry that's been evident in the recent wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, how little we see of the other side, the enemy, and in particular the name that's been given to recent enemies, the insurgent. So I want to sort of pose a set of reflections about why it is that insurgents are so particularly resistant to photographic depiction. More unshowable, I would suggest, than conventional wartime foes. Where does that resistance come from? Now, the second goal, and I approach my sort of task here somewhat as the historian, as provocateur, is to look for elements of continuity where we might be otherwise suggesting radical disjuncture in the digital age. Now, I come to this topic with a rather arcane PhD in British colonial counterinsurgencies of the 1940s and 50s, which back in the early 1990s seemed to be knowledge that had a very small set of potential readers. So I was surprised to find over the last decade how counterinsurgency has made a tremendous comeback, and how recurrent the visual similarities are between insurgencies of the 20th century and the recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I want to use some of those similarities to ask us to think about what is or is perhaps not so disjunctively new about our new media age. Now, before I go any further, I should perhaps specify who the imagined we of my question is. It always seems a little presumptuous to me to pose a first-person plural question. Who are the we that can't see insurgents? Clearly, there can be no universal claims. Since I've observed the events of the last decade unfolding from a vantage point largely in the United States, arguably I should rephrase my question to ask why it is that those in the United States, moderately attentive, shall we say, US citizens, can't see insurgents. But my historical frame of reference, as I've just suggested, is much broader. And my sense is also, although I'd be keen to hear from you, that Canadians probably haven't seen too much more of insurgents either in recent years. Though you'll have to tell me. So let me begin then. Why can't we see insurgents? You also have to tell me if my slides are changing. So the most literal but not entirely satisfying answer is that insurgents don't want to be seen, or not by those outside their own image-making machinery. To be visible in broad daylight is to open oneself to capture by photographers or by the military forces being battled against. Read any account of counterinsurgency war, and you'll likely soon stumble across two repeated motifs. One, that darkness, or night more literally, is such war's truest medium, as Michael Hare wrote of Vietnam. And two, that invisibility, or indistinguishability, is the frustrating hallmark of the insurgent. How does one tell an irregular fighter from a regular civilian? They look the same. Some commentators duly reach the conclusion that they are in fact the same, while others insist that they are quite different if only one could get close enough to establish those distinguishing traits. The insurgent, as this quote from David Halberstam, this is from an article in Harper's Magazine in 1965, as this quote suggests, the insurgent is both an elusive enemy and visually a disappointing one, unmarked when enemies ought to wear their otherness on their sleeve. What the photographer is often left with then is in effect the crime scene without the criminal, the aftermath of the insurgent atrocity. The crime scene without the criminal, the aftermath of the insurgent atrocity, the IED attack, the detonated bomb, but no trace of the perpetrator. And the image that I'm showing here is one of the most widely circulated photographs from Kenya during the so-called Mau Mau emergency of the 1950s, which is striking for its absence of any human characters, the absence of a body, the absence of either a victim or a perpetrator, but merely the bedroom of a six-year-old boy who had been murdered by Mau Mau, which seemed to crystallize the fears of white settlers, the fears of intrusion, of the violation of the sanctity of the home, the young boy's bed left only with the pool of blood. Now, there are, of course, three significant exceptions to my general claim that insurgents remain largely undepicted. Firstly, there have been many photographs, both from Iraq and Afghanistan and from historical colonial wars, of so-called insurgent suspects. These have appeared in large number from both Iraq and Afghanistan, a staple of both professional photojournalism and from the amateur photojournalism that Peter was talking about earlier, most notoriously the images that we've all been repeatedly returning to, made by soldiers and MPs at Abu Ghraib. Such images, whether depicting the moment of capture or the subsequent circumstances of captivity, have a long history. Documents of degradation, they invariably depict an enemy or presumed enemy whose menace is diffused by the humiliation of capture. The contrast in posture, bearing, and attire between capture and captive, in some instances by the abjection of prisoners' treatment, often marks them as less than human. There may be implied, if not more explicitly, almost a species differentiation between us and them, separated by the barbed wire divide. That individuals so pictured are suspected, not confirmed, enemy combatants tends to drop away. The distinction becomes moot. The fact of capture appearing proof enough of an individual's malevolence for captors unmindful, often in any case, of international legal conventions governing the treatment of prisoners in wartime. So this was this image of Viet Cong suspects I was struck by appeared in a photo blog about the history of camouflage. And there, I mean, referring back to the Halberstam quote, there's a sense that somehow the clothing alone, that the black pajamas, that the ragged attire of the Vietnamese peasant itself was enough to mark the individuals photographed here as somehow suspect, and suspect both as a noun and an adjective. And that insurgent suspects have long been photographed in postures of torture. And I show this image to sort of document the 110-year-long history of perpetrators engaged in making photographic records of themselves engaged in atrocity or activities they might not recognize as atrocity. This one from the Philippines in 1901, an early instance of what has subsequently come to be called waterboarding. So the second exception, then, of my general thesis that we don't, by and large, get to see insurgents is that, of course, we do on occasion get to see dead insurgents, or people who are presumed to be insurgents at the moment of their death. Now, the sort of scrupulousness that the Bush administration has brought to bear with regard to images of the wounding, mutilation, death, or treatment of soldiers' corpses when they're on our own side has already been referenced. Strikingly, however, there have been occasions on which the US military has made considerable display of images of enemy dead. For example, these are hugely blown up pictures that were displayed at a US military press briefing in Iraq of Abu Qassam al-Zarqawi. On another occasion, the US military also showed images of two badly wounded sons of Saddam Hussein, a practice which Donald Rumsfeld defended by saying that these deceased were two particularly bad characters, and it's important for the Iraqi people to see them, to know they're gone, to know they're dead. Now, it seems to me that one might press a little further as to the motives of showing dead insurgents, as to whether the purpose is, as Rumsfeld seems to suggest, one of largely reassurance that it's important that Iraqis know these particularly bad guys, in his language, are gone, or whether there's something more sort of pre-modern about the spectacularization of an enemy's death. And certainly, with my own knowledge of the Mau Mau emergency in Kenya in the 1950s, I was struck by the way in which the hanging of Mau Mau insurgents had been a very public affair, as too had the circulation of photographs of the dead, for the purposes, presumably, not of reassurance, but of intending to demoralize an opponent by picturing these often grotesque images of what modern military firepower could do to lightly armed guerrilla fighters in a forest. Now, my third exception to the general rule is that there have also been a long history of photography of soldiers posing with insurgents' body parts. So as soon as I saw this sort of latest set of images, as recently as April of this year in the LA Times, of American soldiers posing with the body parts of dead fighters in Afghanistan, I was immediately recalling a story which I imagine probably no one here would have seen these images because they enjoyed such minuscule circulation. But for 2 weeks in April and May of 1952, the Daily Worker, the Communist Party of Great Britain's newspaper, published a sequence of horrific images. These are, again, the amateur perpetrator photographs taken by British Marines, showing themselves and Dayak soldiers who'd been recruited to fight in Malaya, holding the severed heads of communist terrorists, as Malayan insurgents were often referred to at the time. Now, immediately, as you might imagine, the British colonial authorities assumed that these images circulated in a communist newspaper must necessarily be fakes that were merely serving propaganda purposes. And they were somewhat alarmed to find, on inquiry to General Templer in Malaya, that these photographs were indeed authentic depictions of a practice that he refused to condemn, and was adamant that, in fact, there were occasions on which it was entirely necessary to sever dead enemy fighters' heads for purposes of identification. And the British military had tried to outlaw the taking of such photographs, levying a fine of £23.06 on soldiers caught taking such images, however one determines what the deterrent price might be. But they weren't prepared to outlaw the practice that was caught in the photographs, which to me also evoked an earlier set of amateur photographs dating back to the Pacific War, where American GIs would take photographs of themselves displaying dead Japanese soldiers' corpses, which of course they didn't understand themselves to be in the business of taking images of atrocity. And that was a widely culturally shared assumption, so much so that Life photographed this woman here in Arizona, a war worker, who is the sort of tiny print suggests, is writing a thank you letter to her Navy boyfriend for having sent her the skull of a dead Japanese fighter. Now, one of the things that was also striking to me about the recent scandal over the dead body parts images was the narrow range of meanings attached to them, that somewhat akin to the way in which the Abu Ghraib photographs were dissected in the United States, that very rarely were the Iraqis in the frame ever the object of discussion, let alone of compassion. And similarly here, the range of meanings attached to these were largely on the part of the LA Times that they'd served a necessary public service in circulating these images, which attested the poor state of morale and therefore might contribute to a discussion about whether it was time for a more precipitate drawdown in Afghanistan. And in Leon Panetta's part, he made it clear that he thought the LA Times had done a disservice to American forces by circulating the images at all, because they merely served to animate retaliatory passions in Afghanistan. Therefore, they should not have been published. Now, finally, in my last minute or so remaining, let me come to my sort of main claim, which is there are obviously a range of exceptions when we see in different forms those who are insurgents or presumed to be insurgents in various stages of arrest, if not death or dismemberment. But ultimately, I would argue the reason why we, broadly speaking, don't see insurgents is because the state at war doesn't want us to. And the final case that I would reference here in talking about the range of pressures that the state continues to exercise, threats, pressures, punishments, the lobbying of the sort of collective fury of conservative bloggers and so on, is the case of Bilal Hussein, which I think is an instructive episode in how those unembedded photographers, stringers in Iraq, have been subject to the coercive pressures of the U.S. military. Now, if you're not aware of the case of Bilal Hussein, he was a resident of Ramadi in his early 30s, I believe, when he was hired by AP in 2004 at a time when all American news organizations were radically reducing the number of their own full-time personnel in Iraq and hiring local stringers to work in an increasingly life-threatening environment. Bilal Hussein was subsequently one of a team of AP photographers to win a Pulitzer Prize. And this is the photograph of Hussein's that was part of the collective AP submission that won a Pulitzer, one of a sequence of photographs he'd taken during the Battle of Fallujah. But if these pictures won him a Pulitzer Prize, they also landed him in jail from April 12th of 2006 until April of 2008. Hussein was held by the U.S. military in a variety of locations, including Abu Ghraib, where the precise charges against him remained unspecified until the very moment when he appeared in an Iraqi court in November of 2007. No evidence had been shown to his lawyer until that moment. The case was presided over by a lone Iraqi judge who announced that he was guilty at the outset of proceedings. But the thrust of the case against him was clear enough. The American military let it be known that Hussein was in their custody by leaking this information to conservative blogger Michelle Malkin, who had been a fierce critic of his photography. Hussein was, it was alleged, a suspected terrorist, by implication only someone who colluded with insurgents or was himself an insurgent could possibly photograph such shadowy figures at close quarters or be on the spot to capture the immediate aftermath of explosions. In November of 2007, the military made this charge more explicit, referring to Hussein as a terrorist who had infiltrated the AP. In other words, and this I find fascinating in the sort of insidious ramifications of the charge, he was, if you like, a fake photographer. I'm not disputing the truth value of the images per se, but rather suggesting, as Bush and Rumsfeld had been doing for many months, that a new insurgent tactic was to have insurgents actually infiltrate Western news organizations. As Bush said, they conduct high-profile attacks, hoping that images of violence will demoralize our country and force us to retreat. It's a measure of the intimidatory power of this tactic that AP went back to its archive, checked all 420 of Hussein's photographs that it held on file. And of these, the agency announced that just 37 showed, quotes, insurgents or people who could be insurgents, and a mere 4 depicted wreckage of burning U.S. vehicles. Now, according to Santiago Leon, the Associated Press photo editor, if Bilal had inappropriate ties in the insurgency, as the U.S. military insinuates, actually did more than insinuated, it stated it outright, then you'd expect to see pictures of Humvees flying through the air or dead and wounded U.S. or Iraqi soldiers. Now, that statement also troubles me, for it seems to endorse the Bush administration position that there are indeed terrorist pictures, images that only an insurgent would want Americans to see, and that could serve only to demoralize. Both the AP and the Bush administration thus appear to share a view that certain photographs can do nothing other than terrorize, demoralizing American viewers to the point where they believe the war unwinnable or call for its speedy halt. Now, few scholars of photography would attribute such monolithic power to images. And who knows, perhaps the Bush administration didn't either, merely putting the press on further notice that unembedded journalists were in their sights. My concluding point. I believe that at some level, architects of contemporary war do believe in the power of the power of images to undo military adventures. The idea that visual images lost the war in Vietnam remains alive and well in the Pentagon, if not in the Academy. And the more profusely photographs have come to circulate through unofficial online channels, the more fretful the state at war has become. But there is a final irony here. If Rumsfeld and Bush were truly worried that Americans seeing these photographs taken by the so-called insurgent imposters would cause them to lose faith in the mission in Iraq, the worst had already happened. By the time of Bilal Hussein's imprisonment in 2006, a majority of US citizens had already ceased to support the war in Iraq. So my concluding pessimistic point is this. What the Vietnam War showed and what more recent ventures in Iraq and Afghanistan have reaffirmed is how very long unpopular wars may continue, despite graphic images, despite these iconic testaments to atrocity that we've been talking about and seeing this afternoon. No matter how profusely such images circulate, it's nevertheless proved possible, time and alas again, to continue with unpopular wars years after they first became unpopular. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Susan. Well, Vincent, you have 15 to 20 minutes. Yes, we just need that.
All right, good afternoon. Merci, Thierry. First of all, I would like to thank Kristen Ross and Emilia McGill for having invited me to this panel. My talk of today is based on an essay published in the current issue of Études Photographiques. In this essay, I'm addressing the use by professionals, professional photographers, the use of tools, I mean cam phones, tools usually associated with citizen practices, which I found symptomatic of a profound reshaping of approaches to journalistic output. I have a set of questions to read that has to do with my concern. What is the symbolic benefit or advantage offered to the press professional by the iPhone? What kind of credit and recognition can an experienced photojournalist derive from resorting to a technique that anybody can use? What order of truth does mobile telephony give shape to once it has become part of the information sphere? These issues seem all the more crucial in recent years, which have seen an upsurge in the use of iPhone in war photography, a field that exemplifies photojournalism's highest aspirations. More than just a device for the efficient transmission of visual content, cam phones appears to be a catalyst for the ambitions of today's visual journalism and the emblem of an inexorable recasting of journalistic integrity. Mm-hmm. As such, in October 2010, it became the tool of preference for a small media team chronicling the deployment of a battalion of Marines in southern Afghanistan. Here we are. Okay. Images produced by Balas Gwardi, Rita Lesner, Monica Campbell, and Teru Kuwayama fueled to the open source platform BaseTrack, a provider of alternative visual, audio, and written content. For the most part, the images showed the daily lives of the Marines and the Afghan population, portraying soldiers, everyday objects, and aerial views, as well as subjects less obviously related to the context of war. This is the BaseTrack open source platform. In Afghanistan, in February 2011, photojournalist David Guttenfelder, winner of numerous World Press Awards, used the iPhone's polarized application, which imitates the look of a Polaroid, to produce pallid, washed-out war photographs. The intention was blatantly aesthetic. Some months earlier, the iPhone's journalistic integrity was given a major qualitative boost when the front page of the New York Times showed four pictures taken by photojournalist Damon Winter in northern Afghanistan, an editorial gesture that confirmed the device's legitimacy as a tool for war journalism. Taken in the summer and fall of 2010, the images, grouped together under the title A Groom's Life, follow a Marine battalion in northern Afghanistan. Aside from a few fairly succinct examples, none of these images actually portray combat, their content being mainly the everyday lives of soldiers, leisure activities, camaraderie, maintenance work, household tasks, rest. A lot of rest. A reminder that war can be extremely boring. The visual scope of A Grunt's Life is largely limited to the utterly ordinary in the form of a banal task, such as making breakfast and drying socks, and the presence of commonplace items, including electric razor, a chair, a packet of jam. James Dow's front page article, Between Firefights, Joke, and Sweat, Tales and Tildium, published in the New York Times on November 20, 2010, was accompanied by a series of pictures whose caption underscored the inherent ennui quotient of any military operation. Inside the paper, additional photographs illustrated the rest of the article. However, while the writer alternates accounts of fighting and day-to-day activities, the photographer seems concerned only with the latter, soldiers sharing an iPod, jumping on a wire bed frame, wrestling, asleep in a group, making breakfast and shaving. There are four other images that do point, if only indirectly, to combat situations: an assault rifle and a bed of straw, a soldier climbing a ladder to an observation post, a patrol on the alert, and a Marine brushing dust off his pants after a mortar bomb attack. The indications of clashes and skirmishes are tenuous, discreet, and hard to spot without the help of Dow's text. The relative non-visibility of combat is due to the systematic exclusion of its attributes from the camera's field of view. It is on the periphery of these images, which are free from the conventional notions of war, that the conflict is taking place. In an article published in Lens, the New York Times photojournalism blog, Winter insists that the iPhone allowed him to take photographs that would have been impossible otherwise. I quote him, "The image of men resting together on a rusted bed frame could never have been made with my regular camera. They would have scattered the moment I raised my Canon with a big 24-70 lens attached. But with the iPhone, the men were very comfortable. They always laughed when they saw me shooting with it while professional cameras hung from my shoulders." End of quotation. The iPhone is well suited to scenes perceive as intimate and informal, which is essentially Winter's point, when he suggests a correlation between his chosen recording technique and the level of discretion required, a stealth camera for private situations. In ascribing this kind of discretion to the iPhone, Winter brings to mind the candid photography of the 30s made possible by the advent of miniature cameras that could be used undetected. But more than just an open sesame to exceptional situations, the iPhone functions as an interface for a new kind of sharing between Winter and the soldiers. The soldiers themselves often take pictures of one another with their phones, explained Winter, for whom the device is more a tool for group integration than a force for differentiation. With the mobile phone and the common denominator for all concerned, the usual separation between photographer and subject is diminished, if not eliminated. Due to the moral values that it conveys, courage, selflessness, sacrifice, war photography is considered the noblest of all forms of photojournalism. The icons of photojournalism are mainly war images, conflict zones being the scenes of the most vigorous of political debates, and the front lines acting as the theater for photoreportage's greatest myths. War is photojournalism's paradigmatic setting, the seedbed for its foremost ideals. The paradigm is the yardstick with which to measure the symbolic significance of Winter's images. However, to photograph war with a smartphone, that is to say, with the aid of a technology associated with the strictly dilettantish practice of image making, is to clash with the prevailing values of the field. The strongest reactions came not immediately after the images appeared in New York Times, but several months later, and the reason was simple. On February 7, the POYI, which is the Photographer of the Year International competition, awarded Damon Winter third prize for A Grunt's Life. Here we are. 4 days later, he was named Newspaper Photographer of the Year for his overall achievements in 2010. The news garnered disapproval from a number of photojournalists, from whom this institutional recognition trivialized their profession. They could not understand why a validating body of as respected as POYI would give its seal of approval to work of this kind. The criticism pointed at Winter was directed not at the use of the iPhone as such, but at the epistematic application that he had installed on his smartphone. Epistematic's analog simulation offers square images with imprecise colors, random tones, excessive contrast, ragged edges, and inexact focus. According to those who disparage the use of this application in journalism, Ipstamatic enumerates the mistakes made by amateur photographers. The iPhone, which employs the application, is thus a tool for aesthetic sabotage and deprofessionalization, according to Martin G., features design supervisor at the Boston Globe. We all know the famous slogan that launched the Kodak, the camera that marked the beginning of amateur photography. You press the button, we do the rest. It was a promise of easy as pie photography, a catchphrase that encapsulated the prerequisites for the rise of amateur practice in the late 19th century that triggered the camera's enormous success with the public. Photography had to be turned into the simplest of activities, and this was done by delegating the rest, developing and printing, to industry. This ease gave birth to mass market photography. The amateur could now make his or her own pictures in blissful ignorance of the technical side of the medium. The same liberating ignorance is at work in Winter's recourse to epistematic application. What bothers his detractors is not so much his use of a widely hailed technology as the discarding of an age-old skill. To turn the management of visual testimony over to the crassly popular app market is inconceivable. That institutions such as the New York Times and the POYI should give their blessing in the form of a publication and awards to such deliberate acts of de-skilling is nothing short of heresy. Such is the opinion of a conservative fringe in visual journalism, which sees use of epistematic as irresponsible and an abdication of one's expertise. However, the use of this application in photojournalism actually reveals a strategy of re-legitimization. In one of his most enlightening texts, Jeff Wall, using the term de-skilling, reminds us that the rejection of expertise was an integral part of the recasting of artistic values that marked the 60s and the 70s. Moreover, during that period, it was an imitation of amateur practice that photography undertook the critique of its own precepts, which ensured its artistic modernity. As it happened, this period and its qualitative technical advances in amateur photography coincided with conceptual art's appropriation of the forms of a more primitive amateurism. The marks of incompetence and carelessness found in the work of Ed Ruscha or John Baldessari, exaggerated repetition of motifs, trivial subject matter, bad framing, came to be interpreted as a sign of a salutary deprofessionalization of art. In this respect, conceptual art was updating a prior stance, detectable in the early works of Gustave Courbet, and even so in those of Edouard Manet, that called for a de-emphasizing of the indication of academically learned skill. As John Roberts has pointed out, modern painters were less concerned with adopting the then devaluated methods of craftsmen and the amateur than with sabotaging the normative arsenal of the academy, and most of all, its repressive demand for technical mastery. Today, contemporary art practices are witnessing a revival of the amateur's technological tools, slide carousels, Super 8 projectors, pinhole photography. As Charlotte Lubar states, retro-engineering is the latest of these artist-initiated ventures in technical reversion. Epistematics is part of the same movement advocating the resurgence of outdated aesthetics and procedures. Purely rhetorical though it may be in practice, the analog resurrection promised by epistematic is part of a critical tradition extending from Courbet to conceptualism to retroengineering in an ongoing devaluing of officially recognized skill. Since the 90s, photojournalism has been looking for salvation in the canonical symbols of institutional recognition, large format, luxurious prints, solo exhibitions, affirmation of authorial prerogatives, and admission into significant public and private collections. Then, along came Damon Winter, photographing war with epistematic and forsaking all of these status indicators in favor of, more rewardingly still, deliberate deprofessionalization, technical deflation, conspicuous amateurism, and aesthetic obsolescence. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vincent. Well, Louis, if you...
Okay, just being a little bit of an editor, can we take down the two pictures on each side of the center? It's like a newspaper spread with two ads on each side.
And can we turn the lights down a little bit? I couldn't get criticism for this for later on.
uh,
I want to thank McGill and everybody here for having me here, and it's a real honor to be with everyone here. I just want to point out Susan's book. I actually bought it a year ago at a symposium. Like, I got to own that book, because when you're covering war, everybody thinks it's like logical. Like, yeah, there's the military's controlling me. Like, you got to really pay attention to know what's going on. Like, you can really get lost in what's going on because of what's going on around you every day. What I want to start with is just to take this to a different kind of conversation. We talk about how real photography depicts or captures war, but I covered war for many years. War is not pictures. War is sound. I'll tell you, when you're in a firefight, anybody in a firefight, it's sound. It's screaming people. The visual doesn't really bother you. It's the sound, and it's the smell. I'll tell you, for about 3 years, I couldn't eat meat because the smell of war is unique unto itself. So I remember I came back, I think 2009, from one of my many trips, and a curator's like, we want to do an installation, we want to do something different. And I said, we should go buy rotting meat. And I was a little out of my head, but I just think how crazy the idea was, but it's so real. We should buy rotting meat and hide it in the gallery and just let it rot. People walk and go, what the, that's war. So I just want to throw that in as an extra little thing, and I wouldn't think of doing that now. I just come back, and I'm going to start with a little bit of video I shot. There are three clips. I'm going to show some graphic stuff, and one of these clips is from a frontline trauma room. So anyone who's sensitive to gunfire in here, you should leave the room. Or anyone sensitive to really graphic pictures, if you did serve somewhere, just be reminded what you're going to see. And I just want you to know that these scenes lets you know what's going on around me when I'm taking pictures. So that all these pictures we see, that there's so much chaos going on that sometimes you don't even understand what kind of photo you took. It could take a couple of months before I even see the photo that really suits what I felt like I needed to say about that situation.
Behind you.
So I spent on and off about 5 years in Kandahar. I went to Kandahar because Canada went to war and my country hadn't gone to war since Korea, and I was confused. So I was working at the Globe and Mail. I went for the newspaper, and then I just felt like I grew up on not seeing photo essays in magazines. We didn't really have that in Canada. I grew up on going to the library, and it was like an entire body of work. Like, it made no sense to publish 10 pictures. I thought, well, you know, I saw Robert Frank's The Americans, you got to go do 50, 60 pictures. And I grew up looking at paintings by Paul Nash and Frederick Varley of the First World War. And I went to art school. I didn't study journalism. So for me, the dialogue that I could make with pictures was in that world. Photojournalism seemed pretty boring to me because you'd go after this one pinnacle moment that you had to be lucky to be there. Or get some special skill that you could click the shutter faster. I wasn't really interested in that. I like to spend like 5 years or 2-3 years on something. I just felt like that's when I could really look at something long enough to understand what was going on in front of me. I'm going to show some pictures now. So in all that mayhem that goes on daily for months when I was there, here's sort of how I tried making sense of all that so that, well, first people would publish it, and then, because a lot of people don't publish stuff. That firefight, I was crawling on the ground, that's what I was trying to get to. This guy is just broken down, and he's having a mental breakdown in the middle of the battle. For me, that's war, like the mental breakdown of a human being. It's not so much about bullets, that's kind of part of it. You know, around Kandahar, it's famous for growing grapes. And I just, you know, Caravaggio is one of my favorite painters. So when I saw this like was the Caravaggio painting of the guy eating the grapes. Sort of the contrast of the bullets to the grapes. Kandahar is not a desert area. It's very lush and green. I just felt like with all the images of U.S. soldiers, the U.S. flag all the time, there was a Canada flag in this one. It looked like he was being eaten by the grass. I think to contrast the ugly pictures, you have to show the humanity to be able to describe the inhumanity. This is a wounded Afghan police officer singing and talking to birds. It's very common to own these mina birds there. This is a dead insurgent. I know he's a dead insurgent. I was in the battle where he was killed. He was too far up ahead for me to get to in the battle, but I heard off the base the Afghan police had him and they were keeping his body to trade with the Taliban for a body the Taliban had of their one of their police officers. And they're phoning the police and saying, ha-ha, we have your... It's really horrible what people do in war. And then they took the Taliban's body instead of leaving it there and said, well, when they phoned, they said, well, we got one of your guys now. So they traded bodies. It was hard to get a pub... The trauma room scene, that's your standard image of someone stepping on a landmine. I finally got... No one would publish a photo from one of the many landmine victims there in color, but they wouldn't black and white. And they would because I put the blown off leg out of focus. But very few publications would publish that. This is a Virginia Quarterly Review. This is an Afghan. I really tried to focus on the people caught in between the combatants. This is in a Canadian frontline trauma room where I spend a lot of time. He was just walking down the road, and there was an ambush between Afghan government troops and the insurgents, and he was just shot, killed in the middle of the crossfire. I just feel like the civilians are really important. You know, we talk about combatants, but the Toronto Star wanted to run it in color, so I wanted to show this to show the different sort of things that are... I made a joke about cutting those two things off the other side, but there is white noise going on here, kind of visual noise. And I like the play of, see, now I've lost control, right? Not that I disagree with what's going on here. Embracing the Taliban's the headline. This is not Kandahar, but this is another one of these, and I have to laugh. I've gone to Guantanamo Bay a lot. This is one of those pictures where you lost control, but these hilarious things happen. Like, this is a high-level detainee at Guantanamo, and he's praying. This is, I've only had this access. They stopped giving this kind of access after I published these photos. It looks like he's worshiping the Sprint phone. But then somehow an ad for Homeland Security is up on the New York Times website at the same time of the photo. I just thought it was very, very odd that that could happen. I kept going, and I just thought, I kept running out of ways of taking pictures, and I think that this is what the iPhone has become. It's like, how many thousand photos do I take with the regular camera? Then it's like, I got to do something else. And for me, it was, I just wasn't good at color. I just didn't know how to work it. And then after a while, I had these orphan pictures that were just color only. So in 2010, I decided I didn't want to be with combatants. I went out with medics all the time. So I spent 6 months with a Benevac unit, did 150 casualty pickup missions. And so this is still in Kandahar. This is a hot LZ. It's a landing zone in the middle of a battle. The yellow smoke is what the troops throw down to tell you where to land to pick up casualties. This is like one moment after an IED blast. If you don't know what IED, that's like a homemade bomb. The frontline trauma room, I just, you know, after a while I had to start thinking of ways to take pictures where, you know, these photos ended up being shocking people more than the actual ones of the dismembered people or the blown apart people. This has been published quite a bit. This is not blood. Everybody thinks of blood. It's henna. It's a cultural thing that a lot of the men do. He's just warming his hands up. This is just outside the hospital at the medevac. I had really good access. And that's really what a lot of it is. This is the helicopter's just been bombed. It's 3 a.m. And the emergency backlight went on. I started going out with the troops to show, hey, I can't take pictures at night, but I'll go out when you go out. But the emergency light went on because all the night vision broke when the helicopter went out of control. And that's what was in front of me. These casualties are like 1 or 2 feet from my feet. Like I'm sitting in the back of the helicopter. They're right in front of me. In 2008, after covering about 5 months of frontline fighting, I didn't want to show people shooting at each other anymore. And I wanted to, you know, that Iwo Jima photo with the guys raising the flag? I just feel like it got hijacked from what it was supposed to be by the government. And I just felt like I didn't know who any of those guys were. And I wanted to go to a base that no one covered. So I asked the Marines to send me to the furthest outpost I could go to that no one's covered at the end of their mission. So I went there for a month. And every day I went out in combat, but I didn't take any combat photos. I just did portraits of them every day in the bunker when you arrive. There's a bunker you go into. Every day I did photos, and I maybe spent 2-3 minutes. But I'd spend a day or two just talking to them, get to know them. So I did these portraits. There's 15 altogether. I'm only going to show 5 today because of our time limit. I just asked them to stand in one spot and look at the camera. And I wanted photos. I wanted to break that illusion like the photojournalist is the fly on the wall. I can't be a fly on the wall. I'm 6'2" and 200 pounds. So this thing that we're not there, you know, we're obviously there, you know. So I wanted pictures that looked out at the viewer and said, hey, man, I know you're there. I gave no instructions to them. They just stood. I just where to sit and just so I could take their photo. I have an exhibition coming up. This is not my picture. I have an exhibition coming up at the Houston Center of Photography. It's part of this big war show that Ann Tucker at the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston has curated. One of those portraits is in it. And over the years, I had no idea what I was going to do with it. I thought, I'm going to collect their pictures. So I started collecting. These are pictures by Marines. This is a picture by Lance Corporal Josh Weika. So in the show, there's like about 15 portraits and about 30 pictures by the Marines. So I'm just going to show a couple of examples here. This is an airstrike. And so these pictures will run opposite the portraits of them. And there's some funny things happen. So, you know, they're trying different things. It's this picture of his shadow. These are just with little instamatics. But then you go, you know, your friends on Facebook, right? So they're like posting news reports on the fighting they're doing. And then they say, hey, there's a photo. And look in the background. There's Louis standing up with his brown shirt. So they tag me in the photo. So now they're photographing me and tagging me on Facebook. And this is this picture here. These are all prints now. I made prints of these, and so that these will be shown with the portraits I did with them. Sort of like me photographing them, them photographing me, and sort of our relationship through photography while we're in a war and how we see each other. So I just think some of the funny little comments are hilarious down there. So. And that's my presentation.
Thank you very much, Louis. Well, I have actually many questions, and I'm just struggling a bit with which one I should go with first. Maybe a question for all of you, because you brought very different point of view about the same subject, which is photojournalism, and it's always very interesting for me to have different angles about the same subject. And we heard words like fake, true value, authenticity, real. And it seems to me that all of these words are referring to the same quest, the quest of credibility. And I'd like to ask you, on what do you think this credibility depends on, according to your different point of view?
Who's going first? Who's running into the gunfire first?
But you have more experience.
Oh, God, here we go. Credibility. I think by saying what I do and what I am, and by connecting myself to people who all take a set of beliefs, and I say, look, I believe in these things. I will not do this. I will do this. I will follow this. I will not lie to you. I will do my best. And I think the other thing, too, is that we owe it to you to follow these things. I think that I even put my name out there so that my colleagues, and I expect them to, just as they expect me, if I break those ethical guidelines, and I know that there's some gray areas for some people on what's ethical and what's not, that they'll call me out. That my name is up there and that I sign on publicly to ethical guidelines when I take photographs. Or that I will, yes, sign the embed form and then leave the base without telling them and take pictures of dead insurgents. That I will, it's my goal. I go cover City Hall here and they're going to say, hey, go take the picture from over here, but I'm going to try and sneak over there. That's my job. That's what I think I offer you for how I do things. And that I think I can only put that out there and take the photographs I take and have them published. I don't know if I'm rambling on here. I'm terrified with all these academics in the room and some of the questions earlier on. I'm going to get bombarded. But that by following like a contract that I remain credible with how I take the kind of photos I take, how I take them, how I'm taking them. I'm not telling people to take the gun and point it at that person. That has happened, actually. I will not Photoshop and repeat 5 smoke clouds in a bombing. These are all examples of things people have done. That I will not do that stuff. That I will follow the ethical rules.
I think that the in integrating the amateur, I would say, gestures, techniques, posture, attitude into the professional field, I think there is sort of quest of authenticity according to the idea that a photograph taken with no skill would be more credible than another one. In the aftermath of the London bombing, a lot of photojournalists, commentators, specialists in visual media celebrated this sort of grassroots journalism made in the subway. Well, they called that journalism while there wasn't any intent of information, of course. You are just shocked and you use your apparatus and your device to take pictures. But he celebrated that as a sort of return of basic journalism. They even said that after having taught or having been taught for years in J school, they finally found sort of essence of journalism that rely on the amateur. So we witness in the last decade sort of different strategies to force the amateur techniques to get into the professional field. And I think that this is what happened with Damon Winter in using the iPhone. So that's probably a way to re-legitimize, as I said before, I think, a sort of a connection with the reality that would be possible through the reactivation of a sort of innocence, sort of.
I'm not sure if I have particularly interesting things to say in response to this. I think I myself used a number of those words which you repeated back. And I used them particularly, I think, in the context of the way in which the Bush administration had sought to discredit Bilal Hussein and had been very struck by the way in which it was his actual status that was called into question, that he himself in that discourse appeared as the fake, not his photographs. But the question of the sort of truth value of the pictures isn't one that's perhaps so interesting to me, as I'm not an art historian or an aestheticist. I'm interested in what people do with the pictures and what the political consequentiality of the circulation of images or the absence of other images is, in particular.
But don't you think that the use of these images you are talking about is referring to the credibility of the images? I mean, if the images are not credible, do you really think that they would be used?
Be used in terms of would they be published? Would they gain a certain cultural
you said
status?
Politically used in a political context, right? How do you think that they could use photograph in a political context if they thought that these photographs wouldn't be credible?
It seems to me that the questions about credibility invariably have been asked, I mean, including of those iconic photographs that we've been talking about. People make all sorts of different uses of photographs and others contest the truth content of those images. But, much depends on who the they in your formulation is. And that's what's interesting, I think, is the way in which the status of the image, that precisely those questions themselves get politicized.
So, in a way, we have on one side the amateur aesthetic, the photographs with no skills, as you said, as something go back to the basis. And on the other side, we have Louis, who is clearly referring to Caravaggio and painting references. And I think that this tension is very, very interesting in photojournalism right now. On one side, we almost have video surveillance images that are taken by themselves. And on the other side, we have Louis, who have very clearly a visual background which is clearly sophisticated, and it seems to me that this credibility is totally related to these forms that you are offering to the newspapers and the magazines. That's why I was maybe asking this question. So maybe just to continue, I have another question maybe for Louis, I mean, you said that you went for the Globe and Mail Award, right?
For the first time, yeah.
Yeah, and I was wondering, what did they ask you to something, to photograph something, to bring back something specific, or did they say, okay, go for it and send us pictures?
Well, I had worked there, just the background, for 6 years beforehand. I think we're going to go and cover Canadian troops. They just got deployed. I went there with a writer, and we started thinking of what the stories were. When we got there, we would tell the editor, and I just felt like, for what it was, like, hey, you know, you all want to know what's happening with our country. You want to know all your tax dollars you can spend. You want to know what in Canada's name these people are doing, right? So for that simple purpose, that's all I did. I just felt like it wasn't enough. I just felt like, and it's not a criticism of the Globe and Mail, but for me, I felt the news business, I needed months. I would spend 3 months to get one picture. I don't care. Like, and I just felt like the news business was like in and out. And I quit my job there and I kept going on my own. So I just felt like it was this pinnacle moment for me as an artist, as a photographer, as a person who has ideas who I want to share dialogue in. And I felt like the war was this huge moment. And you know what's funny no one's written about is, can you count how many Canadian photographers covered that war? Almost none. I'd be on the front lines. I wouldn't see a journalist for 4 months. 5 months. Like, daily fighting. You know, you call, like, major news organizations. You're like, oh, you know, there's a crash on Bay Street, Toronto. And it would be like, yeah, but there's some heavy fighting. Oh, yeah, yeah, we're tired. We're on A10 now. You know, we're not. And you'd be shocked. Like, I think the only places that were really interested after a while, the Toronto Star and the CBC. The CBC pretty much funded my whole time there. That's why I shot a lot of video. But really, after a while, then it was CNN. I'd be like, hey, you know, Kandahar. And they're like, oh, we don't have no U.S. troops there. And the war ended up being covered, like, the British in Helmand. So the British only covered there. The Americans only covered the East. And Canada was Kandahar. It got called Kandahar. So I just felt like no one was understanding what was happening where I was. So I had to leave the news business. And I started shooting projects and wait for 3 months. And then I'd say, okay, look, this is what I shot. If you want to publish it, this is what I got. Don't call me and give me an assignment. Tell me where to go because you're not there. So that's how I started doing it. And it worked out. In that case, it worked out well. So that's how I did it.
Thank you. Do you have any question in the public? Yes. Yeah. Just wait for the microphone for the translation.
My question is about the media discourse around amateur photography and videos in the Syrian crisis right now. And it often seems that, well, whenever there is an amateur video or photo taken either by Syrian insurgents, members of the Free Syrian Army, or by Syrian journalists who are amateurs but are becoming professional as they've been working as journalists in the last 19 months in Syria, there's always a vocabulary that discredits the photographs, that questions their authenticity, and some of that is for legal reasons, but some of it also affects the way viewers interpret these images, and I'm wondering what your thoughts were on that.
You mean that a vocabulary that discredits amateur photography?
Yeah, photography and videos taken by either opposition groups in Syria or by Syrians themselves who are working as amateur journalists.
I don't know, but maybe Louis will be could ask that question too, certainly. But it has to do probably with the provenance of the images when you don't know exactly where the images come from. The source of the image, that is something basic in the field, so we need absolutely to know the record of the images. So it's probably, I don't think that it is because images are produced by certain groups that necessarily we feel a bit suspicious about them, but whatever the group that produces these images, we need to know where those images come from. So this is that creates a lot of a shift in this profession. I mean, we're not only asking people to take pictures. I mean, when you are working in the in a magazine, for instance, not only asking people to take pictures, but you are becoming, as an editor, a sort of DG, that you have to create something credible with the mass of information that you get from all of sources. So, and that is very, very challenging, especially since the editorial offices are asking for amateur images for economic reasons too.
I just want to say that being in a war zone for so long, you run across people who are like in the government, and you know, several photos could change a government's policy. A place could get bombed because of photos. And I'll tell you that if you can't verify who took the photo and under what context, and if it's truthful that that's actually what's in the photo, other people could end up getting killed for it. So I think what newspapers are doing, it's not just a legal thing. I think it's ethical. They're saying, we don't know who took this photo and why. But they're actually still doing a service. They're saying, but this photo is still coming out of Syria. It's alarming, but we can't verify. It's like a court case. It's evidence. It's like the Abu Ghraib photos don't mean anything until a journalist actually investigated and published it first, and then the U.S. government investigated and said, yeah, shit, you know, this is...
Oh, and God. When they discovered that from where they were coming from.
Totally.
From the folder. From the
yeah. So I think that, would say, with an AP... You know, if they went and took photos and she's the editor, I'd say, okay, I'm the publisher. Okay, who took those? Okay, they took them. Okay, they're our staff. If someone asks, I can bring them in a courtroom and they say, yes, I took this photo. I followed the ethics. I work for AP. I did see that. It's an evidence thing. But when you don't know where the photos are coming from, you have no idea. Someone could have wrote the caption. Like, you know, it's a very famous example of bad caption writing, and we didn't talk about captions today. You know that famous picture of the helicopter in 1975 on the U.S. embassy? That's not the U.S. embassy. That's CIA headquarters. And a photo editor. So we kept thinking it's U.S. embassy. It's actually CIA headquarters. So forever we thought it's the Americans leaving the last bit of American property in Vietnam. It's actually the Secret Service headquarters. So what I'm saying is at least they tracked that mistake down. When you can't verify, you have no idea. The caption could say, murdered rebel fighter by Assad forces. You have no idea who that person actually is, because you have no one to go to and say, did you do that? So I don't know if that answers your question, but...
My issue is that often the photos are taken by people who identify themselves as reporters that are Syrian, that identify as reporters and are in even informal news agencies in Syria, but they're not formally recognized internationally, and so they lose credibility because of that. You can generally... always go back and find at least a Facebook profile, a Twitter profile for a person who says they took the photo, and for even a group, some kind of informal news agency for them.
I think that if say the New York Times, I can't speak for any of these organizations, but I'm just guessing, and I have worked for a lot of them. I think that the reason no one's going to go on the line for people who sending photos, they're like, hey, they're citizen journalists, is because they aren't recognized yet. They have no idea, like, would this guy manipulate the photo? Would he lie? I have no idea who this person is. So until a news organization can verify that, they're not going to go on the line and say, this is our guy. This is our team. That's like me taking a photo of your neighbor and say, hey, your neighbor murdered someone. You're like, well, I know my neighbor. You didn't do that. And I have people say, well, yes, I witnessed it. And I think that just saying it on Twitter or Facebook, that could be anyone behind that doing something. You have no idea. So that's why that's happening. I'm not saying I support that, but that's how the system is happening, right or wrong or perfectly or not.
My question is for Mr. Palou. Historically, the main critique is that we don't see the horrors of the war. And obviously you got some horrors in your pictures and videos, and you had good access. But how many pictures and videos are stopped because of the editor's censorship?
That's a good question. And I'd invite you guys to jump in after I... Well, you know, sometimes some publications, I won't speak for anyone I've worked for, but just speaking in general, editing and censorship, you know, those are words that you can mix around a little bit, right? I've had exhibitions where I've had galleries put warning signs up, but I've had exhibitions where I've shown hard photos to look at. But I'll tell you, I have a box of prints that no one's ever going to see. Like, you're only seeing a tip of the iceberg here. Like, what people do to each other in war, and what weapons do to people in war, that's nothing. That's like, that's the easy stuff for me to show you. That's, I kind of had to draw the line. Like, I wanted you to see that little video of the landmine guy, like, also because there's the issue of landmines. I'm very into social political aspects, but more and more places are pushing a little bit, because I think that we've been at war for so long, people in positions of power and publications are like, yes, you know what? Like Foreign Policy magazine, the blue picture, no one would publish that picture, but Foreign Policy did recently. And I think it's just, it's a new picture, it's horrific, it kind of shocks people. It's like, yes, we are still at war, this is what war looks like. So the video, well, I don't think you're going to see that on a TV channel anytime soon, that's for sure. Because people will call and complain. It's not like, hey, we want to censor from you. They get complaints. Do you know, I had some stuff published in the Globe and Mail, and they called the newspaper and said, you know, this is I have a subscription. This is a family newspaper. You know, I was eating my cereal and I saw this photo. I don't want to see that photo. So the reaction isn't coming from, hey, you know, the reaction is coming from out there. It's coming from a lot of complaints. People cancel their subscriptions. So I think it's part of the appetite of the audience as well. Because, look, I'm buying this and I don't want to see that. You know, whereas there are people who do champion it as well. But they make judgment calls. Like, I think a famous thing we'd mention is the photos of the burnt bodies hanging in Fallujah, the Americans, they hung from the bridge. A lot of newspapers published those because it was like, this is a changing moment of the war. But I think generally, if you saw what comes across the wires every day, you'd have to, like, get therapy, because I'm telling you, a lot of bad stuff comes across and people just don't publish it. So.
Do we have other questions?
Mike, I have just a quick comment for Susan, but there's a Canadian photographer here that works for Magnum, Larry Towle, who worked in Afghanistan and Iraq for a while, and he had this really interesting set of photographs where he gave the camera to a guy he was working with who brought it then to the insurgents in Afghanistan, and they took pictures of themselves, which then he published in his work, and then was picked up actually by CNN. It was really interesting. And people, there was like the comments that in response to the publication of those photographs were so interesting, because people were outraged about showing the face of the Taliban. Right. So it was just a kind of a comment there. But which I don't really understand why, but they're amazing photographs to see the kind of relaxed face of the so-called insurgents interacting with each other. Yeah. But my question actually was for Louis, and it was about the photograph you described as being a reference to Caravaggio. And if it's a case that your work was trying to think through something of what was going on in that war, why that painting? Why? What work was that history of images doing to speak to that moment?
I just felt like the Caravaggio painting is this really lush, romantic view of the world. It's like I forgot exactly what the painting was called. It's one of the many naked young men holding grapes, eating. Sorry, I don't mean to make fun of that, but the Bacchus, yeah. And I just felt like sort of the daily life of the war that can make just as much an in-depth comment as the dead bodies and the shooting and the chaos of what battle looks like, that it's this sort of sweet and sour thing that I took an inspiration from a painting and took it to an industrial phase by showing bullets in it as well. And that it's the contrast of the organic and the inorganic, sort of the old and the new, and the old is kind of beautiful, but the new is ugly. Kind of like the old times, ironically, like in the Renaissance, where we didn't have the technology and the comforts we have now. We're sort of a more beautiful period, and now what have we grown to? We just make bullets, and for me, it's also a visual hook of aesthetics. I'm an artist. So my whole thing is to get you guys to talk about war, right? If I keep showing you dead bodies and people shooting at each other, and that gets very boring very quick. It's like, oh, great, here's another guy with casings coming out of his gun, or a poor, tired soldier again. And it's just an image that makes people stop. And I don't care if I have to make a nice, arty picture to make fun of it, the way I do it, to stop you and make you talk about the war, then I will. I got to be clever. I got to keep making you talk about the war. That's my mission. So whether I show dead bodies or I keep changing it up and tricking you and surprising you, that's what that is. It's kind of like my little, not to demystify it or make it seem trivial, but it's like my little toolbox of being an artist. I got to keep switching it up on you. I'm happy to have people with iPhones taking pictures. I'm happy to have amateur photographers. I'm happy to have everything as a democracy of photography, that we're all photographers. I'm just one of all of you. I do it the way I do it. I'm trained the way I do it. And, you know, it's like the landing zone picture. For me, I'm landing in the helicopter. I'm thinking, oh, my God, it's a Turner painting. I'm not thinking there's bullets hitting the helicopter. I'm thinking this is a new way of getting you to talk about war, because you're going to stop and look at, oh, what's this? Because we've just been inundated with guys with helmets and guns and helmets and guns. And that's what part of my thinking is that I'm using my arsenal of art history to make pictures that, kind of like how Francis Ford Coppola used Heart of Darkness to do Apocalypse Now. It's kind of the same sort of use, if you understand what I'm doing there. It's taking an old story and giving it a new face to talk about our time now and what's happening now.
Christine, you have a question?
I was going to push you a little further.
Yeah, go ahead.
It sounds like, I think there's something specific about the references that's speaking through you. I'm thinking of the Turner slave ship image, that there's something that's being said about the contemporary situation that the older images are more accurately saying. But that's a different point.
You're going to the bar later, so am I. So we can, after showing you those pictures, everybody needs a drink, right? So.
Yeah, and at the same time, the grapes. Your first comment I liked a lot when you spoke about how the war is perhaps more about smell and sound and the visual in a certain way. And the grapes bring in the element of smell and taste. I mean, it's not the smell and the taste of war, but it does bring in that dimension, which we're not really used to when we're looking at images of war. So that was also bringing a certain, if I can use that word, sensuality to it that we don't often see. So I thought that was really quite striking. I have a question, and I hope it's not a boring one, but it's one that I feel it, which is very important, and which has to do with the digital. Because in a way, that's also the part of the theme of this afternoon. And I was, when I'm listening to all of your talks, and also during the whole day, I really wonder to what point, and is the digital really making a difference? I mean, it's as though we spoke here. We have a title which is in the digital era, and it seems to me that apart from a few things like the circulation of images is different. There are perhaps more images being produced. There is a rise of the ethical, but I'm not sure that I'm compared to, let's say, earlier photography. The ethical has become more important, but at the same time, I don't think it's tied to the digital. And I'm really wondering to what point the digital matters. And if it's not, in a way, that's not where, if we speak about photojournalism and its shifts, it's not really in the difference between the analog and the digital that this is happening. And maybe I'm wrong, but I would like to hear you on that.
That's good. Your question is about what would be different between the analog and the digital.
No, I'm not asking what in a way, because that would be kind of fastidious. So, but in a sense, in a sort of a global way, it seems to me that what your interventions are suggesting is that the digital, the fact that now we are in the era of digital photography, it's not. I mean, the stakes haven't really changed that much. The dilemma, what it is to be a photojournalist, and all these questions about authenticity, about credibility, about professional and amateurism, seems to have been quite present throughout the history of photography. And so in a way, The digital is perhaps not really making a difference with regards to issues or...
Yeah, you're right that these concerns are all over, represent in the history of photography, no problem. But there is something maybe new that occurred in about 20 years ago, just before the I would say the mass uses of digital photography, but amateur. Because the first digital tools were in the newspapers. The problem that occurred is the newspapers realized, the editor realized that a digital file from one computer to another computer, there was always a risk to change things, to doctor the images. So there is, this is why they needed to revise the ethical guidelines at that time. So they produced specific guidelines because of these risks of modifying, sometimes not on purpose, but just the file. So there is certainly a sort of a credibility crisis revolving around the introduction of the digital file in the information field. So there is something of that kind. So there is some change in terms of ethics and guidelines regarding the daily work of photographers, I think.
Yeah, I just want to follow up to what Vincent was saying. Yeah, photographs have always been retouched. I mean, from the beginning of the use of photography in newspapers and magazines, all the photographs have been retouched. I was quoting yesterday during my lecture that I went through about 20,000 images published in L'Illustration before the First World War, and I think that about 80% of these images were retouched. So I think that, I mean, this discovering with Photoshop that we can change the photograph is, I mean, it's almost funny. Because it has always been happening, and I think from my point of view, what happened about with digital era is maybe not about the production again, but it's about the dissemination, and what canals are we using now to disseminate these images, and I'm sure that Louis, you are using a digital camera. But I would say that you are also using traditional, if I may, canals of dissemination. And what's happening is with this the social, you know, media, so it might appear as something so obvious, but I think we have to say it. I mean, the way we access images now is also through this social media. And I think that's something really new, totally linked to the digital appearance by the end of the 1990s. And I was yesterday referring to the images, what happened with Sandy in New York. And I remember because I was at home and I was checking on the web page of Le Monde, and I saw one image and I said, I want to see more, and I went on Facebook. And because some of my friends lives in New York, and I saw images of what was happening at that time. I think that's, for me, that's an access to images that I hadn't before. And that the main change, I would say, in terms of production, I don't know. Even if Vincent talked about the cam phone images made, you know, in London, and that's maybe something else that we have to talk about.
Yeah, just on a practical side, if you shoot professionally, does everybody know what a RAW file is? It's a kind of file that you cannot manipulate the original. And the other thing that you talked about ethics is that, and it's happened, not to me but to other people, where people question a photo. Maybe it's been way over manipulated, colors have been changed, and either contests or people on ethical committees can demand that RAW file, and people have had to supply them. They've either been fired, laid off, or vindicated. So that's another thing. With negatives, it's like a negative. It's a digital negative, actually. You could request a negative, and they'd be like, okay, yep, it's not a copy neg, it's unmanipulated. The basic rules, if you go to the MPPA, the National Press Photographers Association, it's an American organization, photojournalists, Canadians can be part of it. There is an ethical, if you're interested in reading about it, it's a long list of the ethical sort of guidelines. Like, the basic guideline is that it's a truthful representation of what you saw or what you witnessed. That, you know, lightening, basic darkroom techniques, basic lightening and darkening. If there's dust, I can spot the little white spot of dust out. I can crop. But that, and that I'm not going to say, wow, you're crying. Could you cry more? Or, I have this gun. Here, let me move it closer to you. You know, you can't change or affect the scene. If it's a portrait, at the end of the caption you put, here they're posing for a portrait, that kind of thing. So for me, digital, it saves me lots of money, man. No more sending bags of film on some airplane that ends up, where the hell did my film go? Or, you know, if someone wants a picture right away, I can email it. When I first got to Afghanistan, there was no internet, so I'd have like thumb drives I'd send with some convoy, you know, back to Kandahar airfield with some supply guy would get the thumb drive and then deliver it to the media tent. And so it saved me money, and it took out the realities that film would be like, you'd be carrying this bag of film out like a fetus, like, oh my God, nothing happened. It's been 6 months, and if you lose all that film, it's done. You know, I can back up stuff on a hard drive. So, but I adjust my pictures to look like when I shot film. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's in Kikai, I mean, the example you described as right. it was connected into Google Maps, so that it wasn't just an image, it was showing you where.
Yeah.
It was showing you when and what kind of device it was taken.
Yeah.
Which is a whole other world of connectivity between media.
Yeah, there's pro cameras, sorry. With Wi-Fi, sorry, that I could take a picture and it'll go through the internet to my editor somewhere. I don't do that, but the wires, hockey games, it goes straight to the editor.
There's a very interesting documentary from Errol Morris. The title of this documentary, I think, it's a standard operating procedure. What you write, and in this movie, there's an investigator that used forensic techniques to investigate the code of photographs from Abu Ghraib in order to track back. The images in order to know exactly where and when these images was taken. So this is very fantastic. So as you said, there is a lot of information in the file. So, and this documentary is very, very interesting for that reason. A little bit less for others reason, but for that, yeah.
We definitely have information, but maybe not as precise as these ones. When we study prints, we have tags, we have stamps, we have, you know, a lot of information exists. I just want to. I remember something. Once I went to a festival. I mean, and we gathered a lot of agencies. Selling photographs, and I remember that there was a forum about these questions: how to associate data with photographs that we could send. And I mean, I think it was 10 years ago, and it was a kind of revolution. I mean, for in the world of photojournalism at that time, at least it was presented like this, and I think it's very important. And I think we're back to the question of credibility. I think it's all about that too. I mean, it's reassuring us about the content of this photograph. Shall we believe or not on this photograph? We have many information to believe or not in a photograph, and these are among the most important now, I think.
Just touching on the credibility, one of the reasons I like having exhibitions is I have like a public, like a town hall meeting. Like I went there, you know, I started getting chased around bars in Toronto. Like when I got back the first few times, people were like, tell me what it's like. I'd be like running out of the bar. I'd be like, leave me alone. You know, like go look at the photos. That's not enough. You know, so I would have these exhibitions so that people would be like, you know, it's credible. Like I went there. Anyone wants to call me out, this is what I saw. If you don't get anything from the photos, let me explain a little more what I did. So I did a lot of lectures, and I had exhibitions were a great way of what people can go, look, and think. I did one installation where I had headphones with audio, and you could look at the pictures, and you had no idea what the headphones were for. If you put them on, it was combat. So,
do you have the time for one more question? Okay. Just one thing, I mean, because Louis, you are referring to that a lot of time. Right now in Toronto, on Ossington Avenue, in the Auburn Gallery, there is an exhibition by Dominique Nahr that you probably know because he's one of the Canadian photographers being part of Magnum. Why I'm stating this? Because a few times you said, well, I was there and I published there, I published in this magazine, I published in this daily, and I did an exhibition, and you said that like it's normal. You publish, you know, in the newspapers, and at the same time you exhibit your images in art galleries. Can you talk about that? I mean, just about the different status that you have. I mean, I think that being an artist and being a photojournalist, it's different. For me, it's different. And I just want to say that I don't think that 15 years ago we were doing that.
Just so my background, I went to art school. I went to the Ontario, I'm old enough to say it was the Ontario College of Art, just OCA. Now there's OCAD and OCAD-U, they've changed it a million times. I studied art, so... like the whole idea of publishing a magazine is like, hey, I can make $500. But for me, it was about, it's not about, hey, I'm better than everybody else because I got it on the wall or I got it in this big institution. It was more about a place where I could dialogue with you. Like, let's have a talk. Let me create something. It's an idea. It's based on ideas. This is the content. This is a subject that I'm interested in. Come over to this place and let's have a talk. Let me stir a talk. You don't have to agree with me. You can't agree with me. Maybe I stirred an idea. And then I thought, well, look, I can't pay the rent or whatever. I kind of like photojournalism. I like both, and I didn't want to let go of either. And for a long time, for years, the photojournalism people were like, ugh, you're an artist. The artists were like, you're a journalist. And I'm like, I was in this singular lone world. So I just went and struggled to make a living how I could for years. And no one accepted me wholly, like, hey, he's with our camp. No, you're with those guys. They're like, the photographers were like, Louis, he's a little different. He's an artist. And then the artists would be like, oh, you're a journalist. You're not, you think you're an artist, but you're not. You don't understand our the way we think or the way you explain things. You don't consider things enough. And I kept plugging at it, and I don't know what happened in the last 5 years. It's about the last 5 years, where suddenly the journalists are like, wow, Louis does things differently. We need a new way of looking at things. Now the journalists are like, wow, our ways are old and we're not reaching anybody anymore. We need to be more like an artist. And then there are battles in the photojournalism where like, we can't be artists. You know. So I don't know. It was accidental, and I was like the black duck for a long time. So for me, they're all different channels. Gallery, newspaper. It's just, it's a different dog in a different place.
Thank you. Well, I think we're going to stop right here. So thank you very much for your presentation, and thank you very much for your questions.